Hey there, a quick favor. We are conducting an audience survey, and we'd be really grateful if you could take just a few minutes and answer some questions in the survey. Please visit survey.prx.org/world to take the survey today. Again, that's survey.prx.org/world. And thank you. A wildfire is destroying the town of Jasper in the Canadian Rockies, but one resident thinks Mother Nature knows what she's doing.
Within a week to two after being allowed back in, we will walk through the charred blackness and you will see the greenery coming up underneath, that it will look neon in comparison.
I'm Marco Werman. Today, that fire and what comes next for Jasper. Also in Venezuela, an authoritarian president now faces a popular rival who gives people hope. Plus, Saudi Arabia has been named to host next year's Olympic esports.
I want Saudi to be on that list, where when you think about gaming, it's one of the places you think about.
Why that's controversial, and we'll take you to the Paris Olympics, happening now. All that and more today, here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. It is great to have you with us on this Friday. It is opening day for the Paris Olympics. The headline, though, is less rosy. A massive sabotage operation has hobbled trains across France. Authorities say arson has damaged transport infrastructure, leaving tens of thousands of passengers stranded on platforms across the country, including in Paris. The opening ceremonies for the Summer Olympics, though, they have not been interrupted. Athletes are arriving by boat on the Seine, and huge crowds have gathered to see them come in. The World's Jerry Haddon joins us from the banks of the Seine in Paris to give us the latest on everything that's happening. So first, Jerry, bring us up to speed on the widespread sabotage of France's much-lauded train system.
Sure. It's a story that's moving really fast, but what we know as of now is that last night somebody, or rather groups of people, damaged several key train lines in France, mostly by setting fire to railway infrastructure. And the result this morning has been massive delays and cancellations of trains, leaving hundreds of thousands of passengers actually stranded. And at big hubs like Paris's giant Montparnasse station, this morning I found thousands of stranded passengers just sitting around waiting, like Émilie Lacaille and her husband Charles and their 8-year-old son, Swan. We had a 2-hour delay getting into Paris from the east, Émilie said. And our train home to Brittany, it's not even rescheduled yet.
Beaucoup de patience.
Her husband Charles said that they needed a lot of patience.
Yeah, so you said a lot of details still coming in. Do we know who's responsible for the sabotage?
French intelligence and security officials are saying that no arrests have been made, but that they're actively investigating. We also don't know whether the attacks were coordinated or timed to the Olympics, although that is the assumption.
Yeah, well, a very different vibe, I can imagine, than what you're seeing along the banks of the Seine, where you're joining us from. Just paint the picture for us, Jerry. It sounds spectacular.
It is. The opening ceremony, the first ever outside a stadium, has about 80 open vessels motoring along the Seine, covering about 4 miles and carrying the roughly 7,500 athletes, plus all the VIPs, and hundreds of thousands of ticket-holding spectators have at last been allowed to gather in the stands and along the banks to watch the spectacle. There's music and lights, and later on there'll be fireworks, and behind the pageantry, one giant ongoing security operation. But fans don't seem at all worried.
One, two, three!
Earlier, I met a young Frenchman named Bastien Blousseau right by the river's edge. He'd just biked like 15 straight days to get here. He was with a big group of friends, all from the southwest city of Biarritz. He said they'd come to cheer on their country.
Festive, tout à fait. Vraiment content d'arriver là. Beaucoup de monde.
Festive is how he described the scene. Personally, he said he was just so happy to have made it. This place is packed, he said, laughing excitedly.
Yeah, it sounds really electric. So packed crowds, a floating armada of athletes. What are the latest security measures there now?
Well, besides all the metal fencing, which we've reported on, there are now upwards of some 70,000 security personnel patrolling, mostly here in Paris. There are helicopters in the sky and boats and divers in the water. Even the sewers around the Seine have been searched and sealed. Since yesterday, spotters and snipers have taken up positions on rooftops all along the four-mile stretch.
Wow, extraordinary. And have they uncovered anything, any direct plots against the games?
The government is talking about several plots. For example, a 40-year-old Russian chef who was arrested last Friday in Paris for allegedly plotting to, quote, destabilize the games, though we don't have details exactly on what that plan was. Authorities accuse him of working for Russian intelligence services. On Tuesday, police said they arrested an 18-year-old man in France's southwest. He was allegedly plotting a violent attack on the games. And then there was a phony AI-generated video that appeared on Telegram this week, which purported to show a Hamas militant threatening to stage attacks against the games. The French say they believe Russian agents were behind this as well.
Well, French authorities staying busy. And the games themselves, Jerry, now 3 days into some of the early competition. What's going on?
There's lots happening. A world record has already been broken in women's archery by South Korean newcomer 21-year-old Lim Si-hyun. She scored 694 points out of 720, beating the old record by 2 points. In rugby and soccer, hosts France are cleaning up, as was to be expected. The men's soccer team trounced Team USA in round one 3-0. There's just tons going on, Marco, and we'll get to a lot of it hopefully over the next few weeks.
Right, for sure. And on the sports front, there's also lots of controversy as well.
Sadly, yes. There's a giant one centered on Canada's soccer teams. As we reported this week, staff members with Canada's women's team were sent home after being caught secretly filming rival New Zealand during practice using a drone. The scandal has only grown since then. Reports out of Canada allege that the women's team has been doing this for years, actually. Its head coach is now believed to have known what was going on. She's been sent home, too. And some reporting implicates the men's squad as well. But we don't have details yet. But they're already calling it one of the worst moments for sport in Canadian history.
Wow. Soccer is not getting a break in Paris, is it, Jerry?
No, it isn't. Chaos erupted at the close of the Argentina-Morocco men's opener. It's a long story, but basically Argentina equalized in overtime. Moroccan fans stormed the pitch during play. They pelted the Argentine team with bottles. The game was called early, then it wasn't. 2 hours later, the ref suddenly orders the teams back out to play an extra 3 minutes,
wow,
and he takes away Argentina's tying goal after the world's most delayed video replay ever. Argentina is protesting, as are fans.
Inaudito, nunca deberían haber pasado. Creo que le hacen
this is Joaquin Levantón, a young Argentine who's come all the way to Paris with his dog Raquel for the games. What happened was unprecedented, he told me, with a very long face. It's left a stain on the game, he said, and on the ball itself.
Is that it for controversy?
No, there are several political ones. These games have begun amidst, of course, the ongoing wars in Ukraine and in Gaza. But you know what? People along the Seine seem to have their eyes on the sports for now and on this opening ceremony. This is Katie Fleet and George Swansea, two Americans enjoying a drink and waiting, along with thousands of other people, for the ceremonies to begin.
I think it's fantastic right now. Everyone seems really in a great mood and very festive.
It's excellent. This is kind of a nice way to, like, wrap up our time here in France. So, yeah, really enjoying the vibe and high energy. Absolutely.
Well, let's hope, Jerry, we can move beyond controversy over the next couple of weeks and just enjoy the events. That's the world's Jerry Haddon joining us from the banks of the Seine in Paris. Flags are at half-mast in Vietnam today. The ruling Communist Party is mourning and holding a funeral for Nguyen Phu Trong, the leader who died last week at the age of 80. Foreign officials are headed to Hanoi, including U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken. As the world's Patrick Nguyen reports, those dignitaries are paying their respects, but also scrambling for FaceTime with Vietnam's new leader.
The new head of Vietnam's Communist Party had a scandal a few years back. Tô Lâm is his name. The 67-year-old was caught on video eating a $2,000 steak encrusted in gold. It was actually fed to him in London by Salt Bae, a celebrity chef. Kind of a bad look for a communist.
That's the case of a politician being incautious. If it were in America, he'd go on television and apologize.
Carl Thayer is a scholar of Vietnamese politics with the University of New South Wales. Now, Tô Lâm did not apologize, even though, ironically, he has been the top enforcer of an anti-corruption drive called the Blazing Furnace, targeting Vietnamese officials who live beyond their means.
Tô Lâm was both head of public security and a member of the committee to root out corruption among party cadres. And he did it. And you could say he did it with a vengeance.
Thayer says Tô Lâm, despite his indiscretions, has been very effective. As security chief, he's overseen the punishment of more than 200,000 officials, some at the very top of the Communist Party. Under his watch, Vietnam went from super corrupt, according to Transparency International, a watchdog group, to about average. This success is one reason Vietnam's Communist Party picked Tô Lâm to take the reins after the death of its former leader, Nguyen Phu Trong. Here's Tô Lâm on Vietnamese TV, praising his fallen comrade for being an exemplary Marxist.
Với quyết tâm chính trị rất cao, đồng chí thực sự là trụ cột.
There's another reason Tô Lâm is coming out on top. According to Zachary Abuza, a Southeast Asia specialist with the Pentagon's National War College, Tô Lâm made sure to sideline anyone in the Communist Party who might challenge his ascent or snoop into his bank accounts.
All leaders in Vietnam have extensive corporate interests. They're just in the names of their family or close cronies.
Tô Lâm's brother, for example, just happens to be a very wealthy real estate and energy mogul. The net effect of Tô Lâm's purge, Abuza says, is that political infighting is way down.
I expect there to be some stability because, you know, mission accomplished. He's eliminated almost all rivals.
Zachary Abuza also believes Tô Lâm is someone the U.S. can work with. There's a reason America's top diplomat, Antony Blinken, is flying all the way to Hanoi to pay respects. The U.S. and Vietnam are closer than ever, especially their militaries.
We're starting to sell some military equipment. Nothing kinetic, nothing that shoots or goes boom.
But Abuza says the U.S. is trying to strengthen Vietnam's navy to help it stand up to China, as the Chinese military, under leader Xi Jinping, tries to dominate the waters of Southeast Asia. Vietnam's leaders want good ties to the U.S. and China. They try to court all sides, but bow down to none. A core priority is to never, ever again become the proxy of any superpower. Carl Thayer, the Vietnam specialist, says Tô Lâm will keep trying to improve military and economic relations with the U.S. He says Tô Lâm couldn't derail this policy even if he tried. That's not how Vietnam works.
Vietnam is a collective decision-making country. And even though it's socialist, its president is not equivalent to Xi Jinping. The Central Committee controls affairs.
In other words, Tô Lâm, however ambitious, is probably not set up to become a dictator. Whether or not he'll lead as a good Marxist is another question. Worth noting, hours before eating that gold-encrusted steak in London, he did lay flowers at Karl Marx's tomb, posing for a photo op and praising the father of communism. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen, Bangkok.
Here's some news a lot of us might be able to use in 2024.
If you work at a computer all day, then you're going to want to implement the two techniques in this video to save your wrist.
So I've been struggling with a repetitive stress injury, or RSI, on my right elbow for coming up on 4 years now.
Turns out 5,000 years ago, the office workers of that era had their own types of stress injuries.
The mysteries of ancient Egypt and its hidden secrets.
One secret revealed in recent weeks is about the royal scribes of ancient Egypt. It shows they could have had severe backaches from doing their job. Scribes were often depicted in Egyptian art as kneeling or sitting cross-legged, working postures that apparently took a toll on their bodies. A team of anthropologists and Egyptologists in the Czech Republic examined the skeletons of 30 such scribes. They showed more degenerative changes in certain bones and joints compared with 39 other male Egyptian contemporaries.
Scribes made up the very elite, the upper class of Egyptian culture.
That's Foy Scalf at Chicago's Institute for the Study of Ancient Cultures. He says in this period, there were no brushes, let alone pens. Scribes would use the stalks of rushes.
And they would have taken this and actually chewed on the end of the stalk to produce bristles like on a brush.
The Czech scientists found damage to the scribes' molars, consistent with repeatedly chomping on rush stalks, like sharpening a pencil with their teeth. So, jaw pain, clearly, plus achy lower backs and damage to wrists and shoulders, all injuries consistent with the postures of scribes depicted in art from that time. This report is called Ancient Egyptian Scribes and Specific Skeletal Occupational Risk Markers. The authors are from the Czech Institute of Egyptology, Charles University in Prague. The lesson, whether you're stuck at a desk or cross-legged in front of the pharaoh, it's probably a good idea to move around and stretch before getting back to work. Wish I could have told him about the standing desk. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Wildfires are raging across the Canadian provinces of Alberta and British Columbia. The flames have reached the Canadian Rockies, including Jasper National Park, a spectacular evergreen oasis. About half of the nearby town of Jasper has also been destroyed. 25,000 people were ordered to evacuate. Joe Urey was one of them. He's a tour guide and runs a Jasper tour company. I asked him to describe the evacuation.
Let's call it organized chaos. We were expecting this. Since there was a big forest fire that burned the town of Fort McMurray in 2015, and then 2017, we had a big fire in Jasper. We've been living with a list tacked to the wall right beside my front door that says when the fire comes, not if, when the fire comes, you grab the stuff on this list, who's ever in the house, and get going where they tell you to go. So the evac order went out, but try to move 25,000 people expediently with one lane west. And we put our services to that of the municipality and Parks Canada to be directed to where we could grab people who didn't have the means to get out of town sometime. And so I finally ended up leaving town at about 2 o'clock in the morning and joined this snake of red lights that wound its way through the mountains to the next province over into the town of Valemont.
Yeah, well, it's great that so many people were aware and ready to roll. Where do things stand right now in Jasper? Have you been able to get updates?
Parks Canada is doing morning and evening updates. We do have friends and family who remain behind to fight the fire. I mean, these are our volunteer fire department and our Parks Canada's fire personnel. And some of those people have, you know, shot videos out of the town. And so we've been getting kind of those updates. The first updates that started to arrive clearly showed that my end of town, which is the west end of town, was the hardest hit. We come to discover my house is still standing, but it's basically standing in the wasteland. It's everything is leveled all around my house. So I may be one of the fortunate ones who have a roof to go home to.
It's so sad. Do you think there will be efforts to return to the city of Jasper and rebuild?
Yeah, there will be. And, you know, the reality, and I keep making sort of daily posts, try to remind people that we did what we had to do. We got all of our friends and family and our visitors and our pets out safely. And the reality is the rest of the stuff is just that. It's stuff. It's we can get more stuff. We can build new houses. So, you know, it's going to take some time. And before we even are allowed to return or approach the town, our officials are going to have to make sure that it's safe to do so. We don't have any power. We don't have any gas. Probably the sewage facilities aren't working. So they'll have to get all that up and running.
You know, Jasper National Park, it is one of Canada's national treasures, World Heritage Site in 1984. Can you describe Jasper National Park as you know it before it became inflamed?
The river that comes off the Columbia ice fields that runs through the park is the Athabasca River. I call that the lifeblood within my veins. My family have lived along it and been guides along that river from its birth at the Columbia ice fields to its end since it roughly 1870. The mountains, the Assiniboia, as we call them, they're stark and they have withstood time. Their geologic timeline is millions upon millions upon hundreds of millions of years old. They've watched all this happen before.
What is your favorite vista in Jasper National Park? Describe it.
I can't really say that I have one because I get to see all of it on a daily basis. And, you know, sometimes it depends on the time of day, the light of the day, the cloud in the sky, the season. I look upon something else and I've looked at it all for a long, long time and it looks entirely different. And at that very moment, it is my favorite thing. And then I turn my head in another direction and it's like, well, no, change my mind. Pretty hard pressed to not be able to turn 360 and keep doing that same thing over and over and over again. It's remarkable.
That was Joe Urey, who runs the Jasper Tour Company in Canada. E-games or e-sports are now part of the Olympics. Yesterday, the International Olympic Committee voted on a venue. Beginning next year, the games will be held in Saudi Arabia. In e-sports, professional gamers play against each other. Fans gather to watch them, just like they would for any other sport. The World's Shirin Jafari has our story.
This was the scene in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, last December, when hundreds of gamers, mostly young men, gathered from around the globe to compete in video games. The gamers were fixated on their screens. Every now and then, bursts of light lit up the dimmed space. Esports have become popular in Saudi Arabia, where about 60% of the population is under 30 years old. The kingdom has invested heavily in different sports in recent years as part of its Vision 2030 plan. It wants to diversify its economy so that it no longer relies only on oil revenues.
When you talk about gaming, there's certain places that, you know, come off the top of your head.
This is Prince Faisal bin Bandar Al Saud, head of Saudi Arabia's Esports Federation and a member of the royal family.
I want Saudi to be on that list where when you think about gaming, it's one of the places you think about.
He was speaking there with Esports Insider last August. Yesterday's news from the IOC was a major step towards that goal.
With your vote, you have created the Olympic eSports Games.
Saudi Arabia will host the Olympics eGames for 12 years. But the IOC says details like venues and the dates are yet to be determined. Rod Breslau writes about eSports and has been a professional gamer for the past two decades. Online, he's known as Slasher. Breslau says Saudi Arabia's bid to host the eSports Olympic is in line with its other investments in sports, pro wrestling, golf, and Formula One, for example. All of that, he says, is to buy international goodwill.
They're spending so much money, including all this gaming and esports stuff, which is not making money. So it's not like this is a strict business venture for all of these things. It really is to expand their culture and influence on the world.
While Saudi Arabia tries to shore up international recognition, human rights activists accuse its leaders of gross violations of human rights and repression. In a report in 2021, the CIA concluded that the Crown Prince ordered the operation that led to the murder of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi. The kingdom has also come under scrutiny for its treatment of the LGBTQ community. Breslau says there is a robust e-gaming scene in Saudi Arabia.
The players are wonderful. The people involved in the community are great. And it shouldn't have to be that the Saudi gamers, they get penalized too.
The head of the Esports Federation, Faisal bin Bandar Al Saud, told Esports Insider there won't be any restrictions on players.
We are welcoming everyone who would like to come. We are not excluding anyone. We are not pushing anyone. We are very welcoming by nature.
Still, Breslau says many in the industry, including himself, have boycotted attending or watching the games. But he says with the Saudis taking over so much of the industry, it's becoming impossible to steer completely clear of their events.
All of the players and the teams and the game developers and the publishers, oh, it's great for all of them. They're going to make a ton of money, especially with kind of the money that's been hemorrhaging in video games and esports the last couple of years. They really need this funding.
If you're on board, it's incredible, he says. If not, you're probably going to have to leave the industry. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
You're listening to The World. An Iranian businessman operating at home and abroad carries numerous passports and ID cards with different names.
Clearly, you have to be with the intelligence to have this many identifications and passports.
We'll hear about a shadowy network from Iran intimidating and even kidnapping Iranians living abroad. That story's still ahead here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Two notorious drug kingpins from Mexico have been arrested in the United States. One is Joaquin Guzman Lopez, the son of the infamous Sinaloa cartel leader El Chapo Guzman. He is already currently serving a life sentence in a U.S. prison. The second drug lord is one of the co-founders of the Sinaloa cartel. His name is Ismael Zambada, a.k.a. El Mayo. Both were detained in Santa Teresa, New Mexico yesterday. Their capture by U.S. federal agents appears to be quite the tale. Stephen Dudley is the co-founder and co-director of Insight Crime, a think tank and media organization that investigates organized crime in the Americas and the Caribbean. I asked him to explain who these two cartel leaders are.
One is old. Let's call him the super old school one. That's Mayo Zambada. He's been around forever, has never seen the inside of a jail cell, and really was one of the founders of the Sinaloa cartel. And the other is the younger one. Guzman Lopez is part of what they call the Chapitos, which is a sort of reference to being, you know, the younger version of El Chapo, so to say. So those four run their own organization. So that's the lay of the land.
Yeah, so both leaders in the Sinaloa cartel or were. The whole plot to arrest them has a lot of twists and turns. Can you just walk us through it?
What I can tell you is what we know, which is quite vague at this point. There are various stories coming out that are contradictory. The thing that we definitely know is that they flew together from Hermosillo, Mexico, into an airport in New Mexico, seemingly at their own volition, or at least one of them knew where they were going and why they were going there. And that's where it's kind of the intrigue comes in, because the question is, did they hand themselves in together? Were they both tricked to hand themselves in? Or did one of them trick the other to hand themselves in? So it seems to be at least partially or wholly voluntary. And those question marks remain. We don't know, and I'm not sure we're going to know anytime soon.
Well, there's some accounts that suggest it was the young Guzman who lured El Mayo onto a plane to examine clandestine runways. I mean, if that's the case, do we know why the young Guzman would have done that?
Well, first of all, I mean, that is, as you pointed out at the beginning, an incredible tale, because we're talking about a person in El Mayo Zambada who's been around for, you know, nearly five decades in this business. So the presumption would be that he somehow was duped. This is a guy who's never seen the inside of a jail cell and understands exactly how these things work. So that is based on a presumption. And obviously, there is interest on the part of sources from the United States government to put out stories like that. They want to divide them. They want everybody to think that the other is, you know, snitching on the other. And, you know, this serves their interest. So I'm not wholly convinced by these stories just yet. What I will say is that, you know, obviously there are interests in all of these drug traffickers to kind of hand in the other before they themselves, you know, face charges based on testimony of others. So what happens over time is there's a race between them. The person who kind of beats the other to the punch and is providing cooperation and relevant information can benefit often more than the person who comes in second in that race. So there's your interest.
So what happens to the Sinaloa cartel now after losing two top leaders? Can it continue as before?
The Sinaloa cartel at this point is more brand name and almost institutionalized than it is kind of what we think about in kind of reality. Think of it more as kind of McDonald's rather than a very top-down, singularly, you know, hierarchical organization. So it's incredibly decentralized, and it works in decentralized markets. While you do have legacy drugs like cocaine and marijuana and heroin that continue to exist and be important to this particular group, the group also manages a lot of synthetic drugs. And the synthetic drug industry is an incredibly diverse supply chain.
Well, the U.S. Justice Department is focused on the cartel's role in the manufacture and import of fentanyl into the U.S. Do you think these arrests could make a dent in that trade?
I don't, because of exactly that point. These are decentralized supply chains that are really reliant on various and numerous subcontractors.
Has there ever been a successful method or example of dismantling a decentralized cartel in Mexico?
This is a new world in some ways, Marco. The synthetic drug industry is so much more, you know, decentralized, and in that way, it's so much different from the sort of legacy drug world. The global chemical industry is something that I think authorities need to sort of think through very carefully if they're going to have a sort of supply side approach, which is the traditional approach to attack drug trafficking groups.
Stephen Dudley is the co-founder and co-director of Insight Crime, a think tank and media organization that investigates organized crime in the Americas and the Caribbean. Critics of Iran, including those living outside the country, have been targeted by the Iranian regime and silenced. Some have been kidnapped, even killed by secret operatives. In collaboration with On Spec, The World produced an investigative podcast called Lethal Dissent, which we've been airing. For the podcast, reporter Fariba Nawa has been trying to understand exactly how those operatives work. So when members of an Iranian kidnapping ring went on trial in Turkey, Fariba went to observe the proceedings. She met one kidnapping survivor who told her about the Turkish family that tried to abduct him. The Salim family, their patriarch İhsan Salim, liked to wear a black suit with a black tie, cutting a respectful figure, but the conspiracy ran deep, as revealed by a confession from one of the defendants in that Turkish trial, an unassuming Iranian man named Morteza Sultan Sanjari. Fariba Nawa takes a story from here.
Sanjari was a businessman of sorts. He's Iranian.
He started getting involved in trade in 2004 in Iran, and then by 2009, he started doing more trade with Turkey. So Turkey-Iran trade relations, that's where he was more involved.
That's Jalen Akça.
I'm a member of parliament with an opposition party called People's Equality and Democracy Party. I represent a city called Diyarbakır.
She followed the court case carefully because she says it exposed Turkey's dark underworld of organized crime. Sanjari's confession grabbed her attention. Here's why. Sanjari was present for the most important meetings that set the kidnapping plot in motion. He saw all the planning. He knew how the different conspirators were involved and what they did. His testimony is a catalog of damning anecdotes. What follows is his story of the kidnapping plot that landed all the defendants in court. Sanjari speaks Farsi and Turkish. In 2017, he started working for a guy in Iran who imported airplane parts to Iran's Air Force. He said he did accounting for his company. Sometimes his work would take him to Turkey. By 2019, Turkey was becoming Sanjari's home base.
So I actually Googled him and I saw a LinkedIn profile of him. And there he says he's a business specialist with the Salim company. Sanjari starts working with İhsan Salim.
İhsan Salim's company, Bay Salim, sells weapons. Its customers include the Turkish police and Turkish military. Sanjari helped move things along. Then in February 2019, while he's working for İhsan Salim, Sanjari hears from his old boss, the guy who imported airplane parts to Iran's Air Force. He said he needed Sanjari's help. There was an Iranian he was trying to find in Turkey. His name was Mash'ali Firouzeh. Sanjari's old boss said Firouzeh was on the run.
He was with the Iranian Air Force.
And then he fled. Sanjari's former boss, the guy who imported airplane parts for the Iranian Air Force, which, by the way, means he was evading Western sanctions on Iran's military, his name is Hosseini. He didn't just do business that ran afoul of Western sanctions. Hosseini had multiple passports, ID cards with different names.
Clearly, you have to be with the intelligence to have this many identifications and passports.
When Hosseini asked Sanjari for help finding the dissident military officer Firouzeh, Sanjari says he can help.
So he says he could talk to İhsan Salim and then, you know, get the operation going.
All right, like almost a bounty hunter type of thing. Sanjari sets up the relationship. İhsan will find Firouzeh and bring him back to Iran for Hosseini. It's a deal. Hosseini flies to Turkey to supervise the hunt. İhsan Salim searches for Firouzeh, but keeps hitting dead ends. They can't find him. Hosseini's not happy. He asks to be taken to the nearest airport and flies home to Tehran, angry. But once he leaves, İhsan has success.
İhsan actually spots Mash'ali Firouzeh, but he doesn't tell Hosseini his whereabouts. He wants to delay him a bit. That might be because he wants to show his value or delay or just, you know, show that he's capable of the job, but he doesn't want to do it so fast.
What İhsan does do is he devises a plan to get Firouzeh back to Iran and enlist the help of his brothers and cousins. Their plan is to trick Firouzeh.
It appears that the Salim gang convinced him that he would be taken to Iraq and then from there to Israel.
Israel often welcomes military dissidents if they're prepared to defect from Iran. Firouzeh was on board with the plan. Sanjari and İhsan flew with him to Van, a Turkish town on the border of Iran. Van could plausibly be on the way to their destination in Iraq, which was supposedly a waypoint on the way to Israel. But Van is also so close to Iran. Firouzeh was taken across the border from Van in Turkey to Iran. It's not clear how, but once the job was done, İhsan Salim was paid $28,000. Hosseini, the airplane parts guy, delivered the money in person on the border in Van.
And I think that was the initiation ceremony for Ihsan Salam, because this money, 28K, is nothing in other trade deals that he does.
When the kidnapping ring was finally busted and the Salams and their conspirators were tried in court, the prosecutor admitted that the Turkish government had lost track of Firuze. The prosecutor wrote in the indictment that he didn't know if Firuze was alive or dead in Iran. My sources in Iran tell me Firuze is still alive. First, he was in Evin prison, which Human Rights Watch says is notorious for torture. His cell block was called Ward Alef, run by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. Then he was transferred to a secret military prison. My sources found it. It's next to a multi-lane highway in Tehran, the Chamran Expressway. It has what looks like two huge helicopter landing pads. It's where the Iranian government keeps military personnel who are accused of spying or defecting to hostile countries, specifically Israel. After Firuze was successfully kidnapped, Hosseini, the airplane parts guy, invited Ehsan Salam to Iran. He invited Sanjari, too, to translate, since Ehsan couldn't speak Farsi. His presence as a translator is what later made him such a powerful witness. He was literally in the middle of the most incriminating conversations throughout the plot. So Ehsan and Sanjari flew into Ayatollah Khomeini International Airport in Tehran, where Ehsan was treated like a VIP. He was escorted through a private part of the airport.
So only if you are the official of a country. These are only available to high bureaucrats, elected officials, state officials, diplomats. You would be allowed through this section that is called VIP.
And there was a welcoming party waiting for Ehsan.
He's welcomed and received by Hosseini and other intelligence officers. It went all the way high to the highest intelligence officers. For example, we have the head of Iranian military intelligence.
But the red carpet treatment ended at the airport. Ehsan wasn't taken to a luxury hotel. Instead, the intelligence officers took him to a safe house in the suburbs for interrogation. They had questions.
And there he spends a long time. He's actually questioned by some of these high officials.
They wanted to know why Ehsan had withheld information from Hosseini. Why hadn't he told him where Firuze lived as soon as he knew?
And they ask him why he made some issues in the kidnapping of Mashali Firuze when he could have gotten the kidnapping faster, but he took his time and, you know, he didn't do as they asked him.
But the intelligence officers didn't rough Ehsan up. They wanted him to explain how he could be useful to Iranian intelligence.
And Ehsan says, there are three ways that I could be beneficial to you. One being the kidnapping of Iranian dissidents from Turkey to Iran. Two being money laundering or bringing money from Africa. And three, finding safe houses of Israeli intelligence in Iran.
Those were big promises, but just promises. Ehsan needed to deliver. Iran sends Ehsan Salam back to Turkey and assigns him a new target, a former Navy captain, Mohammad Rezaei. Ehsan Salam gets sloppy. So he and the rest of the Salams intercept Rezaei on his bike ride home from work. They persuade him to get into the car, threaten him with a taser, tell him Iranian intelligence is coming to kidnap him, which ironically is true, and they assure him, we're here to save you. But it all falls apart, the entire operation. There were 16 defendants in the court case against the kidnapping ring. That doesn't include Hosseini, the airplane parts guy and Iranian intelligence officer. The indictment says he, quote, could not be apprehended. For the rest of them, Sanjari's confession was the driving force that took them all down. After almost a year and a half, the court case finally came to a close on September 28, 2023.
Beril and I are standing in front of the court before the verdict is announced.
The bailiff announces the proceedings are about to go on. They let in a select number of people. My colleague Beril Eski heads in. I stay outside for half an hour. Then people start coming out.
People look happy. They're coming out now. So Beryl was inside. She's out. She's going to tell us. There's a lot of tears and hugging going on. It looks like a lot of people are acquitted.
Yes, many of the peripheral defendants were acquitted. But I doubt the main defendants were happy with the results. Here's the verdict. Sanjari, 16 years, 8 months. And Ehsan Salem, 15 years, 10 months. Some parts of the sentences are deferred or suspended for good behavior or other circumstances at the judge's discretion. It's unlikely they'll serve the full sentences, ultimately. I tell Betty, but surely they'll go to prison now.
No, they were released from prison until the conviction is finalized. They were released from prison except Sanjari. So only Sanjari will continue to serve in prison. But they're going to be outside with the judiciary control of not leaving the country until the conviction is finalized at the appeal, which is going to take years.
Charged and convicted of espionage and kidnapping and allowed to roam free. What could they do while they're out walking the streets of Turkey? I know one thing Ehsan Salem did. He called me. It was an unknown number. I thought it was a prank call. I hung up. Then he peppered me with a series of WhatsApp messages. I still don't know if what he said to me was a veiled threat. He told me, "What's wrong with you? Why are you trying to ruin my reputation? I'll take you to the prosecutor."
Reporter Fariba Nawa there in Istanbul. This story is part of an investigation called Lethal Dissent from The World and our partner on Spec. To listen to the whole series, go to your favorite podcast app and search for Lethal Dissent. Next week, Fariba deals with the threat from Ehsan Salem and questions government officials about how Iran is getting away with kidnappings and assassinations abroad. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Venezuela is gearing up for a crucial presidential election this weekend. The country's authoritarian leader, Nicolas Maduro, wants to secure another 6 years in power. Under his already 11-year rule, Venezuelans have experienced poverty and repression, not to mention an exodus of millions of people. Now there is a chance Maduro will be defeated by an opposition leader campaigning on hope for change. The World's TV Saizeh has been covering this election from the capital, Caracas. Hey, TV.
Hi, Marco. How are you?
All right. So break it down. Why is this election such a big deal for Venezuela?
Yeah, so under Maduro, Venezuelans have experienced one of the most catastrophic economic collapses in modern history. Economists estimate that Venezuela's economy shrank by up to 80%, and that has meant people falling into extreme poverty, shortage of food, medicine, gas. About a quarter of the population left the country. But for the first time in years, there is an alternative offering real hope for change for millions of Venezuelans. And it's a new leader, a woman called Maria Corina Machado.
So before we talk more about Maria Corina Machado, you mentioned the repression that has emerged under more than a decade of Nicolas Maduro. He is, by any measure, an authoritarian president. Why would he want to hold elections in the first place?
Well, Nicolás Maduro has a problem of legitimacy, and that's because in Venezuela, elections have not been free and fair. We've seen the abuse of state resources, disqualification of opposition candidates, control over the media. And because of this, the opposition has decided not to participate in some of these elections, and he basically has declared himself a winner. And so at the last election in 2018, his victory was not recognized by a number of Western democracies, including the U.S., and the United States imposed a series of sanctions that made the crisis worse. Here is Maduro blaming his country's crisis on the sanctions.
El gobierno imperialista de Estados Unidos dirige una operación.
And so he thinks that if he's recognized as a legitimate president, he can get the sanctions lifted.
So in other words, Maduro has assumed he would win this election. But is his assumption correct? I mean, like, how popular is he right now in Venezuela?
He's not very popular. The most respected polls show he's behind anywhere between 15 and 30 percentage points.
So to what extent are people seeing this as a fair election?
Well, Maduro has absolute control over the media, the court, the oil revenue, and he's used all this in his favor. At Maduro's final campaign event yesterday, I saw dozens of buses bringing people from all over the country. There was a motorbike parade where drivers said they were paid $20 to attend. There was a last-minute special bonus that was distributed. And last but not least, he disqualified the main opposition candidate, Maria Corina Machado, and she had to name a surrogate, Edmundo González, so she's not even on the ballot.
So tell us more about Machado. She seems to be really connecting with Venezuelans politically, but also maybe on a deeper level?
Maria Corina Machado is a longtime politician in Venezuela. She's a strong supporter of the private sector. And she decided to organize the opposition in a moment when many people had given up. Her message is around reuniting families that have been split apart by this massive migration out of the country. Her rallies are incredibly emotional, in which, you know, there is all these people who call their mothers, sibling children in Colombia, Peru, the U.S., from the rally and hold their phones and show their phones to her so they can hear her. So she's basically saying she'll improve the situation so that your loved ones can come back. And it has resonated with many desperate people who want change.
That makes for some real drama here. Let's consider for a moment the day after elections, TV. What are some of the thoughts about what might happen?
No one knows, Marco. There is a lot of uncertainty here in Venezuela. Both sides think they can win, and whatever result is announced will be disputed by the other side for sure.
Si no quieren que Venezuela caiga en un baño de sangre, en una guerra
Maduro
civil,
already said that if he doesn't win, there will be bloodshed and a fratricidal war. And it's unclear if he would try to retain power. But in the streets, there seems to be little appetite for protests given the repression that has happened in the past. So, yes, there is a huge amount of tension in Venezuela right now.
Hoping for cool heads to prevail this weekend. The World's TV Saizea reporting from Caracas, Venezuela. It is a Norwegian family affair in more ways than one. Brothers Henrik, Philippe, and Jakob Ingebrigtsen are a well-known trio in Norway. All three are professional runners. They've also starred in a reality TV show. Oh, and youngest brother Jakob is an Olympic gold medalist, hoping to defend his title in Paris. Now the brothers are adding a new line to their resumes, pop stars. Norge's fort, I dag er vi kongen stolt, I dag er vi kongen stolt, når vi løfter gullet opp. Gjett hvem, bitte lille Norge gjør deg. Yesterday, the Ingebrigtsens released this song. Its title translates to Nobody Does It Better. The chorus goes, People of Norway, today we make the king proud. When we lift the gold up, nobody does it better. In the music video, the brothers, typically serious and reserved, dance in grassy fields and on mountaintops in St. Moritz. It was reportedly produced at a high-altitude training camp. The video also celebrates Norway's Olympic successes over the years. Norway has just over 5 million people and took home 8 medals at the previous summer games. Historically, what they do best is sailing, shooting, and running. And now add the non-Olympic event of singing. If there's an Olympic video or a song from a country that you love, send it to us on X. We'd love to see it. We are at The World. And that is where we'll leave it for today. The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX. broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Have yourselves a great weekend. We'll see you right back here on Monday.